Alan Jorsted, and we have a handsome group out here who will be active in participating and speaking up, because what I've learned is groups like this have so much accumulated wisdom and knowledge and insight that I encourage as much discussion as possible. So I'll start off, and what's that old expression? I'll play a few bars and we'll wing it and, you know, see what happens. Or what's another one? Run it up on a flagpole and see if anybody salutes it. I think that's the way of putting it. But anyway, this is the first of five, and it's basically the enormous changes that have occurred in what I call American religion, or religion in America is actually a better title, since World War II. And when we get going, as you see on the lecture thing on the board there, outline on the board, we'll start with World War II, and today will be the overall view of what happened. And then on Tuesday, we'll do mainline religion, and if we want to talk about the new changes that have taken place with the Lutherans and the Reformed Church and all these things, I'd be glad to talk about that. And then there's no class Wednesday, and then Thursday will be on evangelicals, and people will say, well, how can you talk about evangelicals is different, don't you belong to the Evangelical Lutheran Church? And I'll explain, you know, what I mean by evangelicals. Basically, I mean, you know, Billy Graham kind of thing. Friday will be on Catholics. There'll be enormous, you know, changes that have taken place in the Catholic Church since World War II. And then Saturday on the Jewish community, or in the Jewish community of faith. So one overall broad topic covering these things, and then four specific things as we go along. And as I say, by all means, disagree. I encourage that. Speak up. Let me know what's going on, and we will be out of here tonight for in plenty of time for Vespers. And let me put in a plug also for the book, which the bookstore has recommended. They always ask teachers, as I'm sure you all know by now, to recommend beforehand what title or two they would want. And you were recommending Heschel today, and so on. And I have one over there. It's an orange cover. And it's very, very good. It's the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and they put out 3 years ago an excellent study on the changes, just exactly the things that we're talking about now. And these are very good, and they're reasonably accessible kinds of essays by a series of people across the board. Everything, somebody said, from acupuncture really up to Zen, I suppose you could say, defining religion rather broadly here. Okay, so come right in and sit down. We haven't got to the content yet, but, and another thing I believe strongly in, and I'll be talking about this as we're going, I believe in as much laughter as possible. And some people say, well, shouldn't you be more serious and solemn in class? But I like the adage that I learned from, what is it, Proverbs 17:22, or is it Proverbs 17:23? A cheerful heart is good medicine, but a downcast spirit dries up the bones. And
I that's a good one. Did you hear? A dry bone.
You hadn't heard this before.
He's an MD, folks, so be patient with him. So, right. Anyway, so good. Now, I say that for reasons which I'll be mentioning, but I've got lots of things. And another one, I'm going to be using some sort of one-liners to start with, because I always think that's fine. And day like this, you need all the help you can get, with the weather we've had. And this was a column from Ann Landers, and wonderful ways in which some biblical expressions have somehow become, you know, distorted or messed up or something else like that. And tomorrow I'll be talking about examination bloopers, wonderful things that students say, you know, inadvertently in their discussions. I learned this because in a student once, and I say this, and I when I talk to students, I always have to explain I'm not being sarcastic, because they think when I'm laughing at them when I point out some of these things. And I told them a couple of the ones that I said I found myself using. I was talking once about the system of landowning in medieval France. And I was talking about this, and it came out the system of landowning in medieval France was known as primal genital. And the that was pretty good. Okay. Noah's wife was Joan of Arc. That's right. Lot's years ago, and Lot's wife was a pillar of salt by day and a ball of fire by night. Moses went up to the top of Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments. The seventh commandment is, thou shalt not admit adultery. Jesus was born because Mary had an immaculate contraption. People who followed Jesus were called the 12 decibels. The epistles were the wives of the apostles. That's it. One of the opossums was St. Matthew. Paul preached acrimony, which is another name for marriage. Christians should only have one wife. This is called monotony. And if you have some, and oftentimes they, you know, they have these wonderful mistakes that are made in church bulletins. We'll all go. What is it? At Easter, there's going to be an altar offering, and children will come forward and you know, lay an egg on the altar, what is it? Reverend Jones will have a meeting for young mothers, you know, at 5 o'clock in the church office. If you want to be a young mother, come to Reverend Jones's office and see what happens. Okay. Anyway, comments, questions as we go along, and somebody gives me a high sign that it's time to quit, or we hear the bell or something, that'll be fine. But then tomorrow we'll be on the mainline churches, and by mainline you'll see, Lutheran, Episcopalian, Presbyterian, and what has happened there since World War II. Okay. Since my background is American church history, or we call it now religious history, we start with a historical perspective on this, and you have to put, you know, as a historian or as a teacher, writer, or reader history, you have to put your toe in the water somewhere as the flow of history goes along. And I put the toe in World War I, roughly, of course, World War II, 1939, really till, you know, VJ Day, and then I want to talk, as you'll see also here, something about the Cold War. Now, the Cold War, the World War II really sort of crystallized or brought into clear focus what we mean by the old-time religion. And there, I really think, you know, you can go way back to the Puritans, you can go back to the Catholics in Maryland or something else like this, but I really think there was such a thing as the old-time religion in America, and it was well-known and was pretty well accepted, and it was strengthened and advanced by the needs for World War II. Okay, you know, what do I mean by that? World War II was not just another war, you know, for oil or for coal or for markets or for diamonds or anything else like that, or it wasn't just another imperialistic war. But I think it's fair to say that World War II was a struggle, really, for the survival of civilization such as we know it. If there ever was a time, I think, in which demonic forces were at work, and I'm very careful about using that word, but if there ever was a time in which demonic forces were at work, it was, I think, in World War II. And that was therefore when we became involved, starting with President Roosevelt and then Prime Minister Churchill and all the rest of this, it became clear that this was, as I say, not just another war, and we needed the country, I'm taking it from the national government's perspective here, we needed all the resources, we needed all the strength, we needed all the power we could enlist to get, you know, to get the war prosecuted. I think it's Marin and I are going to do some stories about World War II on Wednesday night, and I'll save some of my stories that I was going to tell here for them. But World War II was this. All right, World War II brought the American people together. This is what I'm just trying to say, in a way which has never been equaled since. In order to prosecute the war, this wasn't just some little war over, you know, in the Philippine Islands or in Cuba or somewhere else like that. But in order to prosecute the war, you had to bring, you know, the country together under a system of specific aims and purposes on which everybody could agree. And this came in right before the war, right before Pearl Harbor, when Prime Minister Churchill and President Roosevelt met off the Atlantic coast and formulated what we call the Four Freedoms. I wish I had the pictures here, because Norman, and I like to use a lot of different media here, Norman Rockwell painted these marvelous descriptions or portrayals of the Four Freedoms. And freedom of religion, where he had people of all different faiths coming together. You didn't find that over on the continent, namely in Nazi Germany. Freedom from fear was my particular favorite one, because it showed parents at night tucking in their daughter going to bed. In other words, no more air raids. And you remember the Battle of Britain, when they had to send the kids out in the country and people had to spend the nights in the subway tubes, as they called them there in London, and all the rest of these things. And then freedom of speech, they showed a young blue-collar worker out in the New England town meeting who could get up and obviously say his piece and didn't have to worry about having approval from anybody like that. And then the other one that we all know, freedom from want, where they have grandma serving the turkey, you know, at Thanksgiving, you know, the white apron and the whole thing, and all the kids and the two, three generations are there. The Four Freedoms became sort of the way in which we understood what we were fighting for. Okay. And so therefore, What I'm suggesting here, that the war became more than a political war. It became more than an economic war. It became really, in every, I think, sense of the word, a religious crusade. Somebody has written a title of, and the title of a book is The Last Good War. And I think that's possibly true. When you look at Korea, and then as we'll get going on Vietnam, and you had the Persian Gulf and all the rest of these things, it was the last war when everything was clear and precise and orderly. And let me give you another couple of examples from music at the time. And if we wanted, we could start singing these, or well, maybe we better late for a letter of this. But think of these wonderful songs that make the point. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Look ahead, there's our field over there with our trust in the Lord and what a blah, 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 blah. We're coming in on a wing and a prayer. There's you got the religious and the military combined at the same time. Or you know, the one that came out of Britain. There'll be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover. Tomorrow, just you wait and see. There'll be peace and laughter and love after ever after. Tomorrow, just you wait and see. And then and Johnny will go to bed in his own little room again. These sort of things. Or there's a star-spangled banner waving somewhere. Where who was it? The great Colin Kelly, wasn't he the great World War II ace? And there'll be Nathan Hale from the Revolutionary War and Colin Kelly too. Patriotism and religion really were, in a very real sense, you know, sort of put together in this particular war. All right, and there was no particular doubt, obviously, that the country had to do this, you know, in order to survive. They didn't have, some of you remember here, you know, they didn't have much trouble mobilizing a country. And it was, of course, the great change in all of American history in the 20th century. Just, I'd like to give just a couple of statistics here. By the time it was over, there were 13 million Americans in uniform, both women and men. For the first time, they had the Wax and the Wrens and the others at this time, and 13 million people. And one of the great changes in American life, and I always like to take a little sample here, was the GI Bill. Just for fun, how many of you had your lives affected by the GI Bill? Usually
free conversion.
What? Free college education. Right. Yeah. Terrific. You could tell your own stories about, you know, what it meant. So the world wasn't the same, you know, once we were in the war. But what was clear was that in order to prosecute the war, we had to be agreed on what we were fighting for. And since we saw it as a religious war, it became clear. This is really sort of the heart of my argument, because we're going to change. This is the heart, really, of old-time religion and going into the new-time religion thing that we'll be talking about here. That it was clear at that time, since the odds were so high and the enemy, you know, was so vivid, and then if you didn't need any further proof of that, we had the Holocaust for this, and then we had the atomic bomb in August, that we were fighting on the basis of the fact that we really believed at that time that there was such a thing as good and evil. There was such a thing as right and wrong. There was such a thing as truth and error. There were really clear, precise, orderly, nice, neat definitions and understandings of what religious faith was all about and caught up in this. Whatever dissent there was, and when we get on the 60s, there'll be plenty of dissent. Whatever dissent there was in 1945, right up till about 1960, was very much muted, because we were, first of all, in the hot war with World War II, and then we were in the Cold War, as we'll get started with here in a little while, with the Russians. Does that make sense, what I'm trying to say? And how the country had to agree and did come to terms on the basis of the fact that their religion wasn't something really that we didn't have the luxury to debate or argue or anything else. But we should mobilize what we stood for in terms of saying this is right and that's wrong. We couldn't, as I like to say, and I'll use this expression later too, we couldn't send World War II back to committee. So oftentimes, if many of you have been in church life, you know, the surest way when you get a controversial thing going, or I found an academic, Duane, I think you'd agree that when you get a controversial thing, best thing you do is send it back to committee.
Right.
My son's an attorney, and they love to send things back to committee. But you can't do that in the war. You have to fight the war is right there. I mean, it's the hot war, and they have to send these things back. So we came up with a conviction, really, that there was such a thing as the old-time religion, and it was clear. And one more reference to, two things here. Reference here to music was the old-time religion could well be summarized by the words in The Little Brown Church in the Vale. I think you all know that particular one, or most of you know that one. It's very clear what that was all about. Or I'll give you another example from music. During the war, just as I grew up, I have to say this, because when we get going on some of this other stuff, we're going to deal with some far out stuff. But my hometown, where I grew up my first 18 years, is in Kenyon, Minnesota. And in Kenyon, there are 8 Norwegian Lutheran churches within 10 miles. Just say, let that soak in for a minute. 8 Norwegian Lutheran churches within 10 miles, and they're still all going. That's cultural homogeneity, if you like big terms with that. So I grew up with very orthodox, traditional, conservative Lutheranism. And when I go off on some far, I have to tell you this story. When I go off on some far out stuff, on New Age and cosmology and all the rest of these things, it's not that I don't know my orthodoxy. That's what I'm trying to say. Because I was doing an elder hostel down in where snowbirds, my wife and I were snowbirds in the wintertime and in around Scottsdale and Mesa and Phoenix and all the rest. I was doing an elder hostel, and there was a woman, an older woman in the back, and I could see she was shaking her head back and forth like this. She wasn't really happy with what I was saying. And then somebody whispered over to her something, and then that was all right. And then finally, when it was over and I asked for questions, her question came up, "Are you the Yorsta boy from Kenyon then?" And, and since I was the Yorsta boy from Kenyon, then it was okay. It was okay. But if I hadn't been the Yorsta boy from Kenyon, I don't know what. And if you come from a background other than southeastern Minnesota Piets, Norwegian Lutheranism, you wouldn't know what that's all about. But I got enough laughs here, so I know that people know what that one's about. Okay, so World War II becomes the agency or the force really that brings the country together, and the instrument for keeping the country united was the need to prosecute the war. I think that's really what I would like to underline as strongly as possible. All right. Then, you know, oftentimes wars, you know, bring people together. You know, the old saying, how are you going to keep them down on the farm after they've seen Paris and everything? And that was true. And you would have thought that there would have been some major, you know, internal social upheavals in this country right after the war. This usually happens after the war. I look at the French Revolution and some of the great things that happened in England. But it wasn't, this didn't happen in this country because we weren't even through with the hot war before we got involved with the Cold War. And we simply traded one, you know, kind of enemy really for another. And to summarize very quickly here, what I'm saying is that it became clear that the communist threat was as great, if not greater, to the very civilization, you know, of the West and all the things that we stood for with democracy and liberty and freedom and the Bill of Rights and all these things as any threat that the Nazis had posed for us. So the country sort of stayed together on the basis of the threat of the Cold War. And it was prosecuted, it was advanced, because by this wonderful sort of coincidence, what happened was that in 1952, the direction of America's foreign policy and domestic policy too, of course, was taken over by the most powerful warrior in all of all times, Dwight Eisenhower. Ike could care less about, remember, he didn't even know what political party he wanted to belong to. It wasn't a Republican Democratic thing. But Ike was considered to be the perfect person to prosecute the Cold War because, as I said, he was the most powerful single military leader, you know, of all time. And hence, the Cold War went forward. The country, in certain ways, in many most important ways, stayed together so long as Eisenhower was in charge of running the Cold War. Hold on to these things, and the churches responded to stay with the old time religion here. The churches responded. You know, perfect example of this would be Ike's Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles. John Foster Dulles was one of the most powerful and influential lay leaders we've ever had in this country. He was one of the founders of the National Council of Churches, and he came from a very strong religious family. Some of you know his brother is a very distinguished Catholic theologian, Avery Dulles. And John Foster Dulles saw America as the leader, not just, you know, from, as I say, markets for coal or oil or something else like that, but for prosecuting and destroying, you know, communism, which was officially dedicated, you know, to atheism. This was pretty strong sort of stuff. And so the old-time religion persisted as an instrument to hold the country together. Already, you know, just sort of getting towards page 2 here, but already some of the forces of dissent were coming forward. I could suggest, for instance, how far some of this conformity got out of hand when we had Senator Joseph McCarthy, you know, from Wisconsin. And I was in Madison at the time. I have to tell this story. I was in Madison at the time doing my graduate work. And I stayed with the family, and they were very strong. And I remember the whole thing. I was staying with a family, the Martins, and they were at the beginning very, very strongly in favor of Senator McCarthy from Appleton, and the prosecution and all the anti-red business and all the rest. And at that time, television was just getting started, and my schedule was to usually go as we call it up the hill, up at Bascom Hill, and either do my teaching assistantship or study or do something. And then I would come home to prepare and read in my room in the afternoon at the Martins, and Mrs. Martin would have the TV on and watching the Army McCarthy hearing. If you remember, it was with the lawyer Joseph Welch and all this incredible story that happened. And every day McCarthy made, you know, even a greater fool of himself than he had the day before. It became hard to do, but he was able to find ways, you know, in order to do this. And she became a little more disenchanted with him every day. And then what happened was that she would watch the live hearings in the afternoon, which were unedited, and then at night CBS or NBC, one of the networks, would have sort of an hour of highlights of the hearing. So she knew what would happen, and Mr. Martin would come, he'd work downtown as an optometrist, and would come home, and she knew what was going to happen all the time. And when she would play, then they would play together, and I couldn't help but hear. I wasn't snooping or anything. I couldn't help but hear, you know, what was going on down there. And finally, there was the last day when all the whole McCarthy thing came, you know, to a great halt. Remember with Joseph Welch, "You sir, have you no shame," when he picked on this one young lawyer and all the rest of these things. And if you don't mind my language here, and I don't mean to offend anybody, but Mrs. Martin, as I said, had started off as strong McCarthy, and I think this was true much of the whole country. She knew what was going to happen next when McCarthy made this incredible mistake on this. And she stood up and she said, "Look at him, look at that goddamn son of a bitch, just look at him," you know. And by that time, it was clear Joseph McCarthy was out of, you know, was over and done. And he was voted the worst of the 96. We had, you know, 48 states in those days. He was voted the worst of the 96 senators, and died in ignominy, I guess you could say. Or the rest. It did, what I'm trying to say here is, using the story, it did get out of hand some places. The blacklist, you know, from writers, academics. I'm trying to think of the Woody Allen movie, it was a Woody Allen movie on the blacklist and all these things. But why I say that, it's a good introduction to what, you know, Paul Harvey, if you remember our old great old radio reporter, would say, page two. So page two would be, now what happens in the 60s to the old time religion? And it became clear that the old-time religion was working, and it helped enormously in prosecuting World War II and keeping the country together during the years of the Cold War. But we like to say that sort of the new age, the new movement started in a whole different direction in and around 1960. There wasn't any sort of official welcoming party or anything else like that. But 1960 becomes a time when it becomes clear that the old-time religion was simply not going to last into the new age. And what happens there, among other things, was that there were four major transformations, the four that I have on the board here, that make it totally impossible for the old-time religion to function the way that it once did. As strong and as powerful and as exciting as it was, I remember myself vividly, maybe some of you too, how important that religious connection was in World War II. We sang to the words of Abide With Me, we sang God Bless Our Lads and Protect Them Wherever They May Be on Air or Land or Sea. We sang that one, and that was pretty heavy stuff. And now much of this simply had gone through the end of the war, and then you know, the 50s, and the 60s come. And what I argue about the 60s is that the old-time religion simply couldn't survive these four, you know, major movements. And these major movements had been here before: the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the ecological movement, and the peace movement. You can find others that we talk about, but I think these were the four that were the most important. And I think they catch on. I think they had been there before. In the 1950s, we had people like Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP working for civil rights through the courts. And that was very slow progress, but nevertheless, it was being done there, but it didn't have the dramatic flair that it had later. We had women's movements going way, way back into history, Betsy Ross and all these, but the women's movement didn't really take off until the 1960s. Same is true with the ecology movement and with the peace movement. Okay, what I'm saying here about these movements is that they caught on, and they became, you know, major forces for change in this country, especially in helping change the old-time religion. because they took on a religious dimension or a religious quality to them that they hadn't had, that they really hadn't had before. I'm wondering if the civil rights movement, who knows, it's one of these things that games historians play, but if the civil rights movement could have caught on at all, had it not been for the fact that it became identified, you know, with Martin Luther King and the ministers of the time, and northern ministers too. You got northern white ministers involved with it, as well as the Southern Christian Leadership Association. And that gave it a dimension, a power, I should say, here that it didn't have before. And it also meant that there was no way in which you could delay, you know, making decisions on civil rights. That's the most important point. To use my joke from before, or the quip from before, you couldn't send civil rights back to committee. You would have to act. Once Bull, you know, the sheriff or the chief of police down in Birmingham turned the dogs and the fire hoses loose on the students, there was no way you could say, we're going to think about it, or we have, what's that old one, we have to change the hearts of people before we can have civil rights legislation. That used to be an old one for a lot of people, sincerely believed that. What is it, let there be peace on earth and let it begin with me. Well, that might take forever if you know, remember they threw the bombs into the Sunday schools and the black school and the black churches and all the rest of these things. You couldn't put it off any longer. And so the old idea that there were clear, precise, neat, orderly, you know, true and false, right and wrong, ideas about civil rights simply went out the window. Okay, so we usually date the civil rights movement, to give historians like dates, with the first, you know, student sit-in in 1960 at North Carolina A&I, and then it took off, and most of you will remember that. Okay, the second one is, I'm just summarizing the highlights here. The second one is a women's movement, and we like to give the date there, 1963, when Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique. A book which brought together a lot of ideas which had been floating around here and there in different places, and gave it a focus and a direction that it hadn't had before. And what happens now with the women's movement, in a way it was beholden to the civil rights movement, because it talked about oppression and second-class citizenship and inferiority and all the rest of these things. And she's even talking up here, Rosemary Ruther has talked up here. She links the women's movement and the black liberation movement is sort of together. Okay. Women's movement comes along, and again, it can't be postponed because it becomes clear, obviously, of the double standard for such a long period of time. And it's no accident, just in terms of timing here, that in 1970, the Lutheran Church started ordaining, and not all Lutherans, but anyway, the old ALC, the old ELC, and then the LCA started ordained women. The Episcopalians, 1972, if I'm not mistaken, is the time that happened. And I just one other quote here, and some of you know back in Minneapolis, he's not on anymore, but we had a religion show every Sunday morning with John Gallus on Channel 4. And John was interviewing me one day, and it was going on the whole women's movement thing. And I'll tell another story about that in a minute. But anyway, John was interviewing me, and I said, if God didn't want women, this is an inspiration came to me, I hadn't planned it. If God didn't want women to be ordained, why did he make them so well qualified? And the switchboard lit up at that particular point on old Channel 4. But I remember the other story I have to tell. This is a local thing, and you can relate that, your Seahawks people, to your situation. We were, the Vikings were in big trouble for a long time, so they were going to save the Vikings by having Herschel Walker come in. They traded away the franchise for 10 years or something. And so then in order to, you know, help Herschel's salary, they gave him a TV show. And in order to make it really good, they had brand new furniture. And I walked in for my interview that time with John on the program, and here I saw the Herschel Walker set. Immaculate, purple and gold and new and shiny and gleaming and everything else. We walked over to poor John Gallus's little old, you know, set over here on the other end of, WCCO, and it was really pretty tacky. But then John said, you know, you see who runs things around here, was his way of putting it. And so I think the Vikings have finally come back, but it's been a long, long time. All right. Anyway, the women's movement got started. You can't delay it. And you can't sort of resort to some of the old cliches any longer. That's what I'm trying to say. And the same thing is true with the ecological movement. All right. Usually in dates, we put the ecological movement with a wonderful book. It's still worth reading, Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, 1962. This is still, she was a poet. She wrote beautifully. And the title really gives it away. Suppose spring came and it was silent. Suppose all the DDTs and the pesticides and all the other things came and nothing happened. I mean, we had killed nature. And I mention this in terms of the old time religion, because for a long time, much of American religion had simply backed and supported, you know, virtually unlimited economic expansion and development and growth in the name of jobs and opportunity and markets and profits and all these things. Now, for the first time, the churches had to face up to the fact that we were the, you know, I know I'm preaching to the choir here, so I'll make this short. We were custodians of the earth, that we had responsibility, you know, to the next generation, to the next centuries. And as again, it was something where the old answers no longer worked. That's what I mean by the breakdown of the old time religion. And the last one, of course, is the peace movement. And the peace movement comes along and changes things, because, you know, in American history, there was this sort of idea that we had never fought a bad or a wrong war. We had always been, you know, right in what we were doing. You go back to the Revolution, the War of 1812. You know, we have the war with Mexico. The Mexicans don't think that, you know, we were, the United States was quite right in that war. And so on, the Civil War, well, that was sort of a draw. Then the war with the Spanish. Then World War I, remember Woodrow Wilson's crusade to make the world safe for democracy, and the war to end all wars. In other words, and then World War II, that's why I put so much emphasis on that. We had always been on the right side, you know, in wars. And suddenly, this war comes along and it becomes clear that we were on the wrong side, totally on the wrong side, and how long and how difficult it was for Americans to accept that. I know myself, I thought of that today when we were talking, that I was so caught up. I was 11 years old when the war started, and my two brothers were in the war, and my one brother was on Iwo Jima, and so on. I had two cousins who came back, you know, who were killed in action, and so on. I was so caught up in that sort of thing that when it came time for the Vietnamese war, I couldn't believe for a long time that the United States could actually have been on the wrong side in the war. It took me a long, long time to believe that. Maybe some of you, Brad, you're nodding, I think that was true. And it was actually, he was then Senator George McGovern, wrote a fine piece in the Progressive that sort of helped change my mind. At that time, Senator Mondale also was on that, but it took a long time. But suddenly, you know, the old idea that America had never done anything wrong before, because, you know, God was on our side, all this sort of vanished, and it became very clear that the old traditional myths and legends that we had believed in simply no longer sufficed. And I always tell people, maybe some of you would want to comment on this, if you wonder about this, just go sometime to the Vietnamese War Memorial, you know, on the Mall in Washington, and see the names of 58,102, I think it is, is that the exact number or something else like that. And I always say, don't plan on doing anything after you've been there, because the rest of your day will be, you know, a wipeout from this. But I think it's clear that as hard as it was for so many people to accept, that the old ideas simply no longer sufficed. So if you put these four together, and I'd be glad for your comments on this, what I'm trying to say is that the old idea that there was always a right and there was always a wrong, there was always a good side, there was always a bad side, there was always truth on one side and falsity on the other, and that all this could have been wrapped up in the sort of the older traditional, more conservative kind of approach to American faith, simply evaporates in the 1960s. And it's gone, and it's you're never really able to bring it back again. I remember we had, just at St. Olaf of all places, we had the student takeover. We had Kent State. And did we ever have a Kent State? We had the students come in, and they marched into the administration building, and I shouldn't, but anyway. some of you might know Sidney Rand. Very dignified, wonderful president, think the world of him, but not one who would cater much to students. I think that's a fair way of putting it to Sidney. Very dignified and everything else. And this young student comes in and looks at him. Rand was in his office, and he pointed his finger. He said, "Out, Sid, can you imagine?" You know. And Rand handled just well. A lot of colleges really blew things up. At Cornell, it was a disaster. Columbia, boy, people were killed on campus. And of course, the ultimate disaster was on Kent State, where four unarmed people were killed by the Ohio's, you know, National Guard, and so on. But it happened there. And if there ever had been an idea, you know, that a college like St. Olaf or Luther or Augustana or any of the others, Gustavus, had been sort of isolated provincial colleges, you know, divorced from the world, that simply evaporated, you know, at that particular point. And we had to come to terms with what the world has offered us from that point on. Okay, that would be sort of the second chapter of what I'm trying to talk about here on the old-time religion. Does that make sense? I think especially the pressing nature of this, and the churches would have to make a response on all these four issues. That's the point. You couldn't not only delay these things, but you couldn't waffle on these things. These were such important issues that they caused the, they were really, put it this way, they were really the beginnings of the rifts that we still find within most of the major, you know, religious, I mean, Protestant and the Catholic denominations too at this particular time. That are going on. And that before, while, I'll say this on Thursday when we got going on the Catholics, or Friday on the Catholics, before, while most of the, if you want to put it that way, the animosity and the conflict in American Christianity was between Catholic and Protestant, that just sort of vanishes. This vanishes, especially after Vatican II and John 23 and all those things. And now, part of what I call the New Time Religion is that the real animosity and the conflict comes within the denominations themselves. Lutherans trying to define what Lutheranism is. And we've got all kinds of different groups, you know, on that. Same thing is true with Presbyterians or Methodists. We have the good, some of you might know in the Methodism, it's called the Good News, you know, sort of subdivision here. We had, I had his name, the leader of it, Robert Kaiser, and his daughter was Nancy, was at St. Olaf, and it was always interesting to talk to her, you know, about what was going on in the Methodist Church. And my wife and I had a sabbatical. I was here in 86 on the Village, and then I was writing a book, and then I went second semester to Berkeley, to the Graduate Theological Union. And they did something so intelligent there, it sort of blew my mind, because I couldn't believe that academics could do anything that, you know, that well planned. They have 8 seminaries within 2 miles, and then there's the Presbyterian one is over on the other side of the bay. But they built a library, you know, right there, right where all the other, where the seminaries are, so they could avoid duplication. And so I had seen an ad in the Christian Century, you know, spend your sabbatical here. And then I did some checking, and I found out that the new library was right directly across the street from the Episcopalian Seminary, Church Divinity School of the Pacific, dear old CDSP. And I have to say this, I get off the subject, but I've got a new audience here, and you haven't heard these jokes. So anyway, we went there, and it was the most cheerfully disorganized place I've ever seen in my life. That's the only word I've seen some cheerfully disorganized places, and some cheerfully unorganized places too, like when I was in the Army. This, on the other hand, if we think, you know, we lived right in the Catholic, in the Episcopalian Seminary, the guest house, Gibbs Hall, right across the street, and a wonderful library to work in, and it's got some great artwork there. If you're ever in Berkeley, that go up to 2451 Ridge Road and see the Graduate Theological Union thing, and you can see how ecumenism works. You've got the Unitarians and Catholics and Presbyterians and Lutherans and Baptists, and they all, you know, sort of work together. Okay. But anyway, what happened was that we lived there, and we, you know, at the dormitory, and what we found up close was, if you think Lutherans had problems, you ought to, you know, check in with the Episcopalians. I mean, they had some real problems. Oh, they Thursday night they would have what they call community night. They'd have a dinner, and then the people would come in, you know, from the parishes and all the rest, and they would simply, you know, hang it all, let it all hang out. And we heard some real anguish and some real difficulties and the problems that are going on there, and it hasn't been helped, you know, over the years. So what I'm trying to suggest here is that the older, traditional, staid, conservative, dignified churches like the Episcopalian or the Lutheran and all the rest simply couldn't hold that old status in line any longer because of the new forces that were at work. So what's happened now is what I have on the board here for the New Time Religion, and I just want to go through a couple of the highlights here. And is this any time to have a comment or discussion on this, if you want to. Okay. So what happens now, as I say, that clearly the battles are no longer Catholic versus Protestant. I mean, we could all go through that, and maybe you grew up as I did in this little town where, you know, we didn't associate with the Catholics. We didn't buy from the Flick Brothers grocery store because they were Catholics, and we didn't have a Lutheran grocer in Kenyon, but we had an Episcopalian, so he had to do Archie Kramer, and that was about the best that we could do with that. And we didn't date, but then I have to say, we didn't date the Haugi Lutherans either. I really liked her, Alice Dierdal, and I really liked her, and she said, "Erling, I'd like to go out with you, but, you know, you're not going to go to heaven And so so that was the end of dating, you know, our Helgi Lutheran. And she did marry another nice Helgi Lutheran boy, Donnie Groen. They had six kids, and that's fun. Okay. Anyway, enormous changes come about, and I think the overall most important one, and I've just been reading some new good stuff on this, and I'm sure this is right, is the change, you know, in the what we would call the matter of authority of the church itself. Rather than having sort of, and I'll talk about this a lot tomorrow, rather than having sort of religious faith defined especially by doctrine, by our creed, in our particular case by, you know, Luther and what I learned in the small catechism, now the real locus, the real, you know, the real sort of center really is much more on experiential feeling kinds of thing rather than on the, you know, the old traditional classical authority of the church. The role of the minister would be a good example of this. I'll wander in and out of the topics which you have on the board here. Because the old traditional role of the pastor, and I know this was true in the Catholic Church and the Episcopalian Church, Presbyterian and the other mainline ones, was to be obviously the one who administered the sacraments, but also was a teacher. That was important. And that's why it was so important in the mainline churches to have a very well-educated clergy. And that still, of course, is essential. Because when I go Thursday on the evangelicals, this is no longer that important in this country, to have a well-educated clergy. But in our country it was, starting right with Luther and Calvin and Knox, the Wesleys and all the rest, on this, because it is so important to have the information, the insight, the theology and all these things, you know, just right. And the seminaries in those days, and this lasted really into the 70s, were the seminaries taught doctrine, they taught ethics, they taught Bible, they taught church history, and the basic, you know, sort of core curriculum. And now, obviously, this has changed enormously to where the role of the pastor is much more one of being, you know, a counselor, an advisor, a psychotherapist, if you like, rather than the one in the ministers expected, you know, to be friendly, to be, you know, active in the Rotary, to be active in Little League. And can you imagine, I was thinking back on some of these old patriarchs that we had in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Can you imagine some of these guys going to Rotary and being tail twisters and bell ringers? And I was thinking Reverend Simonson was the one I grew up with, an old, dignified person. And his sermons, of course, were perfect. No, perfect. They were very well crafted. That was the important point, the proclamation on Sunday morning. And he simply didn't get involved in all the other things. The same thing is true with fundraising, you know, with all these other things. But I think clearly the shift has been away from defining religious faith primarily as assent to, you know, true doctrine, to where now it's much more an emphasis on what can religious faith do for me? How can I be happier? How can I be a better person? How can I live up to my potential? How can I do all these other things? A shift really away from one to the other. And I think in the large part that has been due to the influence, and I think all this, much of this I think is very constructive and helpful, to the influence of the whole field of psychology, which has come into its own really as an accepted you know, discipline and a way of dealing with people's problems in a way which is parallel to, but not directly that of the, you know, finding the answers, you know, just in Scripture. I don't know if that makes any sense. What I'm trying to say is that we expect pastors now to be well trained in counseling and in, you know, interpersonal relationships. In if you've got a rebellious teenager, if you've got a marriage in trouble, you've got a, you know, AA problem, whatever it might be, the pastor is not only expected to know, you know, through his Greek and his Hebrew and his theology and all the rest, all these things, but the pastor is expected to know her or his, you know, counseling. And that means that the focus, so to speak, is more on interpersonal relationships than it is on pure theology. With the exception, of course, of Missouri and Wisconsin, at least in our things. Missouri and Wisconsin still hold you know, to pure doctrine as absolutely essential. And I would say myself personally, and I'll be glad, I guess I'm going on tape on this, but that's all right, on this, that I say sometimes it becomes almost sectarian. To where that becomes the only thing really that counts is pure doctrine. And that's, if I get some, you know, letters, you can write me an email, I'll tell about on the tape here on that thing, but don't call me on that one. But anyway, I think that's true. But my own feeling is that also the new time religion has taken over because the old time religion has become sort of a generational sort of thing. You don't find younger people, with a few exceptions, always there are exceptions, but you don't find younger people that much interested any longer in doctrine. in learning, you know, the faith simply through, you know, appropriating the great truths that were taught. I mean, maybe some of you had the experience that I did. I was taught that religious faith came when I had memorized Luther's Small Catechism and I could recite it, you know, on the night before, or the Friday night before confirmation. And once I had the answers in place, then I could be confirmed. Now, isn't it true that sometimes they have kids having, you have trouble getting kids even to come to confirmation? And that it's very difficult to get them to learn anything. And I respect one fellow, he was a pastor out of Chapman confirmation. And he had the students come in the candidates come in for an interview beforehand to talk with him. And five of them couldn't explain to him what the Lutherans meant by grace. Yeah, that's pretty essential, you know, and if you're going to become a member of the church and everything else. And Dave did not confirm that. And you know what hit the fan at that particular point when Dave didn't do that. Because confirmation was, you know, a family rite where you had a big dinner and you had presents and, you know, had the godfather and the godmother and all these things in. And Dave said no because they did not understand, you know, doctrine as the essential Lutheran teaching on grace as being essential for this. And, you know, the inevitable story was he was asked, you know, politely and firmly, but firmly, I should say, to leave. And that was really, you know, too bad. Okay, it doesn't happen everywhere. So I think the shift from the authority, from scripture, from doctrine, over to experiential religion, especially through, I think, psychology, has become very, very important. I'm just going to go through these other ones here, right? Another one, as I, in a way, I've hinted at this, is the change in what the minister is expected to be. One way you can find sort of good proof or evidence of the shift from the old time to the new time religion is to look at the catalogs of the courses in the seminaries over the years. You will find, you know, just exactly what I'm talking about. Now one of the most important fields, and I'm, you know, delighted to, grateful that it's here, is pastoral psychology. You wouldn't have found that 20, 30, 40 years ago. All the other things that are connected with this have taken place there, and the minister is expected to be much more. What's the term some of you know about our seminary, Pat Kiefert? He says that the minister is expected to be a family chaplain. And he says that with some sarcasm. if you know Pat, he doesn't mince words. But he's expected to be a family chaplain. That's to take care of these things, rather than to be the person who proclaims and, you know, proclaims the gospel and administers the sacraments on this. I think that's very important in the new time religion. Okay. And another thing that's happened is, in this country, to break down the old-time religion, is the fact that so many Americans, by necessity to keep their jobs, have to move often. Okay, now what do I mean by that? The old-time religion, and this ties in with the ethnic churches too, you had the Italian churches in Boston, the German Catholic churches in Milwaukee, let's say, and the Polish churches in Detroit and so on. They all lasted and had power and strength because they were sort of ethnic havens where you kept up the language of the mother country, you kept up the old foods and the celebration of the feasts and all the rest of these things. You always knew you could go down and find Father Kelly or whoever it was, you know, who could take care of you if your boy wound up in jail or something else like that on this. And they held together for a very long time. And you could keep up the old time religion so long as you had the ethnic loyalty at work for you. On this. But ethnic loyalty starts to break down clearly, starting in the 70s, and clearly is very strong now, especially through intermarriage. Intermarriage, more than anything else, has broken down the, you know, the old ethnic loyalty churches, where young people simply don't care any longer what it meant to be an Italian or a Pole or a German or a Norwegian or anything else like that. And you find intermarriage, you know, occurring. I'll give you an example. Right after speaking in World War II, my brother he was in the Marine Corps, chaplain's assistant, and he met at Camp Pendleton just by San Diego, he met Frieda, and Frieda was a Methodist. And you, when Curtis, after the war, brought home Frieda, a Methodist, you would have thought back in my little hometown of Kenyon, he was bringing somebody from the Ubangi tribe in Africa. You know, a Methodist was considered to simply be, you know, not acceptable. And today you would be so grateful if your child brought home, you know, a Christian. Speak from experience here, Erling, that's for sure. That simply wouldn't be a problem any longer. Okay. That's what I mean by intermarriage on these things. And the other thing is that you can't hold on to the old-time religion if you're moving all the time, or if you have your congregation, you know, basically, you know, turning over all the time. There are new studies, and the Alban Institute has some really good stuff on this, showing the enormous turnover in membership in the churches. And when you have that, that means that you can't sink the roots down into the old places any longer and hold on and have the same family sort of run the place. Some of you who may have parish experience, you know that one good way of, one effective way at least of getting a church working is to get five or six families and simply, you know, let them do this. And that's what we see in the church we belong to now in Scottsdale. There's a real tussle over that. And so if you're moving, and if your company, say you work for American Express, or you work for some big insurance company, and your company said if you want to be promoted, you have to move from Cincinnati to Denver, you know, and you want to do that to help your family or something else like that, that means that you move and you have to start all over again at the church, the First Presbyterian Church or whatever it is in Denver. And you have to make friends, and you have to sort of rearrange the way in which power is, you know, distributed, and the way in which decisions are made there. And the church keeps going in this particular way, round and round. And the old-time religion, the old sort of ruling, you know, families and traditions simply no longer work. Does that make sense? I want to be sure. What is it Dan Rather calls this? A reality check? Every so often, I think I want to do that. And the ethnic loyalties, and then, of course, we're in the 80s, we get going into a whole new set of issues which are so difficult and so baffling, and Holden has been one of the leaders in many of these issues here, that the old-time religion simply no longer, you know, suffices. And I would say, for instance, the ordination of homosexuals is a major case there. There's a program tonight on this here at the Village, and the Village has been very strong on this. And the other one, of course, is abortion. And how can you, what I'm trying to suggest here is that how can you hold on to preserve what some people would still like to hold on to with the old-time religion when you have problems, you know, with the enormous difficulties of and the complexities that these two, you know, particular problems or these two situations have. They didn't have those before for the reasons I think we all know. And sometimes people just simply wanted to not face these, but clearly they're before us, and neither are going to go away. I mean, you know, that's, I don't know if you want to call that the good news or the bad news, but neither of those two particular problems are going to go away. And as much as you would like to have them go away or be, you know, eliminated, they aren't going to do it.
Thing I'm interested in, you do not have economic issues or poverty among...
I could on the new issues.
On the old, and it struck me, the conversation we had at breakfast this morning, that Martin Luther King was assassinated shortly after he made the move to, you know, the poor people's march and economic issues.
Right.
Mm-hmm. LBJ raised that, the war on poverty, but that all of a sudden got lost in the Vietnam War.
Right.
And there's sort of a furtive starts in the 60s to address economic issues. Somehow didn't carry through.
The only economic issues would have been the ecological or environmental ones. Yeah. And the churches simply, for a long time, and even today, they haven't been that directly engaged in them. That's what I'm trying to suggest by not bringing them in there.
Okay.
Yeah. But clearly, I tried out here 7-8 years ago to have a forum on is capitalism Christian? And well, there was this, and you talk about not getting a discussion started. You were the one who mentioned that. I was ready to do somersaults or, you know, do a tap dance or something else like that. New jokes, right? To get just to get the discussion started on this one. It didn't take. And we always have some new commission, you know, and the churches have some new commission studying these things, and they're very sincere and try very hard, and it just sort of lays an egg. Because people don't, for whatever reason, don't want to talk about it, right, on the economic issues. But I think, and then you know, that's a tough one, right? Yeah, in the back there, is it, Brad?
There was a discussion of something very similar to that just a day or two ago, right, in this very room.
Okay.
So
about the economic thing?
Pardon?
About the economic issues?
Yeah.
Was that the one that this afternoon?
Bill Grace submitted two or three days ago.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you what may be a kind of irrelevant question. Do you know the origin of the song from which you get your title? Give me that old-time religion. Where does that come from? Is that black? Is that white?
No, it's a white
18th
song.
18th century, or?
I used to, for when I did this at older hostels, I used to have a Xerox and hand it around, and we would sing it, and then everybody would sort of giggle about the fact that nobody could sing it well. And then I used that sort of as an icebreaker. And I don't know. I just don't. I could look it up. I'm sure maybe Dan Coleman would know, our musician here. And so up in the balcony.
From the story about the pastor that was asked to leave because of the mm-hmm. question of confirmation.
Right.
And I'm curious, what happened to him? Did the church stand behind him? Why was the bishop there? What was the official position?
Yeah, right, sure. Don't quote me because this is, but anyway, a lot of people don't like this, but the bishop and the leadership in the church stood with Dave, but by that time there had been so much rancor and acrimony in the church that he could no longer be the pastor that he knew he had to be. I mean, sometimes, I don't know if you've ever heard a wonderful expert on this, Peter Steinke talks about what happens when you get illness, so to speak, get into your congregation, and when distrust and suspicion and rumors and all these things happen, and he said it acts almost like a cancer. And he said there are two ways of doing it. You can attack it directly and you're going to get problems, or you can simply say, I can't deal with it, and you just simply, leave. And Dave couldn't cope with it anymore because the problem had got, to that particular point.
He was very, very outspoken. What kind of follow-up was there on it?
Oh, well, he left. I don't know what's happened since.
Well, I'm wondering in the church. I mean, is this a social club now or what?
I wish I knew. I follow Dave. He's now got, some of you might know, he's got this nice church right by the Minneapolis airport. This one right on Cedar and 62nd. Where they've got it so soundproof that you can't hear the airplanes going by, and doing just fine. He's one of my real heroes that I stood for him. I wish I knew more about it, but that's.
Well, I think it's an alarming story, yeah. In terms of the.
But I think all of us.
All of the church and the community and what it really means to people, because it always has been something of a social club. We know that the ethnic aspects, as you pointed out. Have a lot of social.
You think yourself, in your parishes, everybody here, what happens when you get a new minister? You get maybe 10 to 12, maybe 15 families drop out because they don't like the new minister. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with the fact that he's Lutheran or Presbyterian or anything else. But we just had that down in Scottsdale, where I'm from. And the ministers, and we got to talking with them. And you see, I'm lucky, I go to pastor's tech study every Tuesday. They have 12 to 15 pastors in the conference meet every Tuesday for a serious tech study. And so they get a lot of times to get away from the tech study, and then we get going on things like that. And the pastor started sharing notes, and it's anywhere from 10 to 15, sometimes 20 families that'll leave just simply because of the personalities. And then we had one, a very attractive interim pastor there, and they followed him all the way across town, and that's a whole ways. That's like 35 miles if you're going to go from Scottsdale to Sun City West or something. But they wanted to go with the minister, the social club thing, rather than than stay there in the congregation. And that's a fact of life. Mm-hmm. And the assistants to the bishops are usually the one who have to go out and try to put out the fires, right? One here, he's been here many times, Don Rudwood. Don does it, for David Olson in Minneapolis. And Don would tell, he was here last year. And Don, I don't know if you know Don, he works for, and he had been in North Minneapolis in inner city ministry, especially with Native Americans, and he could tell some great stories, some very sad stories, just about these kinds of situations. And you can't, in a way, it's you're trapped by the congregational system, because you have to, as a pastor, you have to work with who is out there. You can't simply come in and say, as some authoritarians would or some of the sects would, here is the way it is, period, and if you don't like it, you can move. You have to work with people where they're at. A good example, I imagine this would happen to many of you, would be the whole matter of how much contemporary music, folk music and all the rest, do you bring in? And how much do you keep of the old, traditional kind of one? You have to work, with the people who are there. And what happened in our church in Scottsdale was that, thank goodness, the person who brought in some really rinky-tink sort of stuff realized there was a lot of hostility and just resigned, thank goodness. I have to tell the one on Marin here, it is right in here, when somebody tried to do some rinky-tink stuff for Vespers at Holden, And I never forget Carol. This is one of his best little quotes. And there was somebody who came in, and it was some, you know, soulful person with a guitar and all the rest. And Carol was doing an imitation of him. And he said, he got out his guitar and he said, "Oh, how I love Jesus, plunk, plunk. Oh, how I love Jesus, plunk, plunk." And he said, that was it. That was the end of it. And we didn't get more plunk, plunk music at the at this from that point on. Sure.
I wonder if you have any thoughts or advice for any of us who struggle with some changes that we may not like, mm-hmm. and yet we want to go along and not yeah. worry about. If they bring in incense, we wouldn't like it very well, but could we be educated that maybe there's something good about this? Or bringing in the Bible, the gospel, and everybody facing the Bible and turning like this.
Well, that's
it
very
seems so silly, and yet it's very meaningful to a lot of people.
That the reading the gospel from the center of the congregation is very traditional.
Well, I didn't mean to make from one issue, but there are a lot of things could come in. A new organist, a new choir director may have different kinds of music, or we may have... insist on communion every Sunday, and that's the trend, and that's...
Well, what's happening is that clearly there's a trend, you know, what I call a downsizing or shifting away from letting the central authority make these decisions for you. This is just as true in the Catholic Church, which used to be, you know, very hierarchical and authoritarian as in the Protestant churches, and now it's basically up, if not to the Synod, or the conference, it's up to the local parish. And sometimes when people get irate because of music or incense or something, you just ask them, where are you going to go? And what has to happen, I think, is that there has to be, it should be open discussion and dialogue within the parish. And not be afraid to disagree. That's when we mentioned about people not wanting to speak up on things. Sometimes we've got this idea, and I guess I'm preaching to the choir here, but we've got this idea that everything in church and discussion should always be nice and polite and pleasant. And everything else. I remember Dr. Grasco, our president, had the best statement on this, and then it's time for wrestlers. He was talking to the senior class, and he said, if you came to St. Olaf thinking that you were going to get a nice education and you were going to be with nice people and you were going out of here feeling nice, he said, we failed you completely. And I never forgot that, and I think a lot of times in churches, you know, we dress up and we're supposed to be nice on Sundays. We can raise hell all we want in the office, you know, in business or wherever it might be, or in the faculty meeting or something else like that, but not in church. And I think that would be the way of opening up and keeping it open, but keeping it on an issue thing and staying away from personalities. Because then we get into the personality thing that I was talking with Maren here that happened out in Cheska. Once you get into personalities, then, you know, forget it. It's a lost cause at that point. Yeah. So come back tomorrow, 10:30, we'll take this up. I don't want to hold back anybody from Westbrook.